In 2019, a political earthquake occurred in the United Kingdom. In that election, the Conservative Party led by Boris Johnson gained 48 seats in England, many of them coming in the North and Midland regions, two regions that had voted solidly for Labour for almost 100 years. Now, imagine if the Liberal Party of Canada won half or more seats in Alberta during a federal election. Now, that's the equivalent of what happened in the UK in 2019. Now, this shocker didn't come from nowhere. For years, Labour support in the region had been deteriorating. And in 2016, two-thirds to three-quarters of those living in these constituencies voted to leave the EU in the Brexit referendum. Welcome back to In Focus with David Coletto. I'm David Coletto. What happened in England that caused these safe Labour seats to switch to the Conservatives? How did the party of Margaret Thatcher convince these working-class constituencies who only decades earlier chastised her over her government's policies to vote for a party that most would say didn't represent their interests? My guest on this episode of In Focus is UK pollster Deborah Madison, the founder of polling firm Britain Thinks. Deborah was pollster to former UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown. In 2010, she published Talking to a Brick Wall, the story of the new Labour years through the eyes of voters. Her latest book, Beyond the Red Wall, explores how British left-behind communities created the electoral earthquake in 2019. I just finished reading this book and am thrilled that Deborah agreed to talk with me. It's a fascinating and insightful read, and I believe her findings need to be read, absorbed, and understood by everyone involved in politics, public affairs, and those interested in the future of democracy in the United Kingdom, the US, and Canada. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Well, Deborah, thank you so much for joining the podcast. And as I said, I just finished your book. I happened upon it. Someone shared it on Twitter and I was like, oh, this sounds amazing. And it was an amazing book. And as a market researcher, as a pollster, I've been asking most of the interviewers a first question. And that is, in your work, as you approach trying to measure public opinion, understanding what audiences think, do you have an overarching framework or philosophy that guides your approach to public opinion research?
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting question. And I think the first thing I'd like to say in answer is not so much about how I do the research, but why I do the research. And if I have any kind of overarching or guiding principle, it's that I really believe passionately that the people whose lives are affected by the decisions that powerful people make, whether it's people running companies, whether it's people running governments locally, nationally, have an absolute right to have their voices heard and, where possible, to actually have a say and actively have a say. And, you know, if there's been any thread that's sort of run through my career and all of the things that I have done, I think it's been that. And it's been how the role that I can play in enabling that and helping it to happen. And that, you know, thinking about the kinds of things that you do, well, that obviously shows a role for polling, for you know, quantitative polling, but it also shows the role for qualitative research, where you can dig much deeper and understand much more. And it also shows what you can do with deliberative research. So, you know, the kind of how I always explain it to people is ordinary opinion polling will tell you what people think, you know, given how little they know. But if you can do deliberative research, what you can do is they come on the journey with you and you empower them and give them the data, the information, the knowledge that they need to become part of the decision-making process. And that, I think, is one of the most exciting things that I've done in the last decade or so is, you know, a lot of deliberative research. But, you know, basically my start point is people need to be heard. And, you know, if I'm talking to politicians, sometimes they'll say, well, you know, I talk to people in my constituency, I run surgeries and people come along. And I'm like, no, you need to know what people say about you when you are not in the room. Yes. Not what they say when they're feeling polite, right, when they're being a bit intimidated, when they've got a problem they want you to fix. But what do they say about you when you're not in the room. And that's, you know, you need the truth.
And I think that's such an important starting point, because, and I think if that's the philosophy, if your goal and your objective is to bring people's voices into a process that could exclude them and has often excluded them. It does exclude them.
Mainly excludes them, I would say, I'm afraid.
That approach also will affect the way you do research, right? Because as we know, you know, we all have biases and the systems have biases that affect even the questions we ask, right? So if you're asking questions from the perspective of a government, of a corporation, of a union, they're going to want you to ask questions in certain ways. But if you approach the work from, I really want to hear what people, whether it's union members, whether it's the public, whether it's customers think, then I want to start where they are, not where my client is, right?
Absolutely. I have a great example of that, actually, which in fact makes the case for one of the most traditional and old-fashioned methodologies there is, which is diaries, keeping diaries. Because what a diary method, whether you do it, you know, in a more modern online way or literally with pen and paper, it enables you to understand what people think without you having framed their thinking by asking the question in the first place, just what is on their mind. And a good example of that is some work that we did called the Brexit Diaries, which was trying to sort of understand what had happened after the Brexit vote in the UK. One really fascinating finding was we just asked people, we picked 100 people, 52 of whom had voted leave, 48 of whom had voted remain, so see what we did there. And we asked them to keep diaries, they were all around the country, just anything that occurred to them when they thought about Brexit. This was after the vote, so it had all, you know, the vote had happened. And what was fascinating was that the people who had voted remain picked up news and talked all the time about the economic factors that had driven their decision in the first place, and they were now bemoaning would be affected by the result. By contrast, the Leave voters never, ever, ever mentioned the economy, not one of them. They just didn't pick up any economic stories. They're, you know, the things that they picked up to do with Brexit were to do with entirely different things and to do with this sort of concept of taking back control, of Britain being in control of its own legislature and so on. And it was just such an interesting insight because, you know, if we'd framed the question by saying, how do you think the economy is going to affect Brexit, you'd have got a very different result. But that tells really clearly what had driven the decision making of those different groups.
It was and these diaries, just so our listeners understand, is you're basically asking a random group of people to just keep their thoughts on paper, online, however that you're collecting it, without prompting them to answer about a particular subject. So you know, every day, sit down, what's caught your attention? What are you thinking about?
Yeah.
And you get to really understand what's top of mind and what are they, how are they, what's their worldview in terms of that, what's going on in the world at any given moment. In the same way that I interviewed another researcher in my first season of this, and she said, I often start a research project. So I've been given a task and I'm going to maybe design a survey or a discussion guide. And I start by just going on social media and seeing how people talk about whatever issue. So I'll just start searching, right? It's another example. Like, I guess Twitter in a way is like a mini diary as we're commenting on and reacting to things that we're seeing without someone asking a question of us.
Exactly. Really, because that already starts to frame how they're going to respond. You've fed them some cues.
So you have been studying public opinion in the UK, Britain for many years. And I'm a huge, I'll use the term, you know, junkie of UK politics. It's been a fascinating decade. Let's just say that.
It sure has.
and as it's been in many countries. But if you met somebody who didn't know much about, you know, the state of public opinion or didn't know, you know, the British people very well, how would you describe, and your company's name is Britain Think. So how would you describe what Britain Thinks
now? Well, interestingly, so one of the things that we've been doing at Britain Thinks over the last few years is a tracker that we call Mood of the Nation. And we're literally tracking how positive or negative people feel overall about the country, about their own lives, about their own community, and then doing some deep dives with qualitative research, with focus groups to really understand. The overall mood when we first did it, and this is sort of 3 or 4 years ago. So in the almost immediate aftermath, actually, of the Brexit vote, was as pessimistic and gloomy as I had ever seen it. And in fact, we gave the study to a Sunday newspaper here called The Observer, who used it as their headline, and they said, you know, kind of, you know, gloomiest nation ever kind of thing. What has happened since then is it's got worse, actually. Oh. So we repeated the survey most recently last autumn. We found then that 3/4 of us felt pessimistic or very pessimistic about the country's future. And that was, you know, up 10 points from the last time we'd run the survey. So, you know, it had got worse. So, you know, it was already bad. People felt that the nation was already divided, that, you know, coronavirus then had just added to that feeling of anxiety and concern that people had. And people were talking about how worried they were for their mental health, how worried they were about the economy, how worried they were about coronavirus, how divided they continued to feel the country was. So it has got worse. The one thing I would say, though, is that the mood is also very volatile.
Mm.
So here in the UK, and I don't know how many of your listeners will follow UK politics, you obviously do, but basically we have had a very successful vaccine rollout.
Right.
After a rather difficult, you know, we had to go back into a second hard lockdown. It was all very difficult, and all of our numbers, our infection numbers and deaths and so on sort of, you know, rocketed up. And it was a very, very tough time. But successful vaccine rollout coinciding with beautiful sunny days, mm-hmm. springtime. And actually the mood has turned round and people now are feeling a lot more optimistic. But who knows what's around right. the corner? I mean, I think the big takeout at the moment is that people's moods change, you know, in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
So, anything can happen, I think.
We see that in Canada, too. And it almost for the last year, or at least the last 6 months, corresponded with news around either, you know, the case numbers. You can actually track.
Yes.
It's correlated so strongly with the daily new case counts and how people are feeling about the pandemic. And then that translates into their broader mood. So when vaccine rollouts are starting and numbers are improving, you know, the country is feeling good, and we're now actually in the worst wave that we've had here in Canada.
You're having a very bad time there at the moment, aren't
and
you?
The yeah. mood is really sour. People are just feeling quite upset. Yeah. And just to another parallel, I interviewed John Anzalone, Joe Biden's pollster, last week, and yeah. we were talking about how the mood of the United States, Americans, is at the highest it's been in years in terms of their yes. just right direction, wrong direction, right?
Yes.
We're close to half of Americans saying yes. it. So you're right. It's so volatile. I mean, it's great news to hear that you guys have turned the corner and that your vaccine role has been so successful. And I can't wait to get back and visit London and the UK as quickly as I can.
But hopefully you'll be able to do so quite soon.
I want to switch and really focus on why we're really talking, which is your book, Beyond the Red Wall, Why Labour Lost, How the Conservatives Won, and What Will Happen Next. It was published by Bite Back Publishing in last year. And as I said, I gobbled it up. It was, you know, because you use qualitative research, you had, you know, tons of just great quotes and verbatim from real people telling you how they were feeling and why they were behaving and thinking the way that they did. So maybe I got a whole number of questions here, but let's start with, as we often do as researchers, the methodology, right?
Yeah.
And start with maybe why you wrote this book and how you went about collecting the data you used to tell the story that you so effectively did.
Sure. So why? Gosh, I don't know if you know, but before I set up Britain Thinks, I used to be a pollster for the Labour Party and the Labour in government, particularly working with Gordon Brown, who was our Chancellor of the Exchequer and then Prime Minister. So quite a long period of time working with Labour. And when this Red Wall thing first kind of came to my awareness, I'd never heard of it. It was a journalist in London actually rang me up and asked me what I thought, and she explained it. And I'm like, well, come on. She said, well, the Tories are targeting these seats and mm-hmm. they think they're going to do very well. And I said, oh, come on. You know, these people are classic you know, working class Labour voters, they are almost allergic to the Tory party. There's no way, especially there's no way they'll vote for an old Etonian, you know, who spouts Latin, and no way, it's not going
to
happen.
I just to interrupt you, I'm a big fan of like Billy Elliot. And like, if our listeners don't know what region of the country we're talking about, just think yeah. of, right. Think of that either movie or musical and the exactly. kinds of working class, you know, former coal miner kind of communities, right, in the north of England.
Exactly that. It's working class people from very traditional, you know, and if people are listening from the States, then we're talking the Rust Belt states. It's exactly the same. They, you know, it's the same people. These are very rundown places. You know, when you chat to people about their place, they talk a lot about the glory of the past, but they're all facing very uncertain futures. So, mm-hmm. so that's the backdrop. Anyway, I realized when I thought about it, you know, that I had never ever, I think I might have actually done focus groups for a couple of by-elections, you know, like local elections, but other than that, nothing. And then, of course, we know what happened on election night. And in case any of your listeners don't know what happened, it was an absolute rout for Labour. Labour, two-thirds of the seats that Labour lost, it lost in those red wall areas. Mm-hmm. Started with a constituency called Blythe Valley, which sounds very, very pretty, and then continued. And I thought, gosh, you know, I am so out of touch, not having done this kind of work. I have got to get back in there. I was just so puzzled to understand what had gone on. And so what I decided to do, I used a lot of published polling and quantitative polling. I drew on some of the work that Britain Thinks had done in terms of the national mood. But the main thing that I did was a mix of focus groups and ethnographic interviews with people that I selected. And I focused on three constituencies. One, which is a place called Darlington, up in the northeast, which is actually coincidentally where I was born, which is one of the reasons why I chose it, but I hadn't lived there since I was a child. It's the home of the railway in Britain, so very proud kind of industrial past. Then a place called Hindburn, which is in Lancashire on the northwest side of the country. Again, a very proud industrial past, partly the weaving industry, but also it was the home of the so-called Norrey brick, that's iron backwards, right. Strongest brick in the world. And that brick factory has closed and shut and opened and closed, and it's become a political football. Anyway, again, a very interesting place. And then the third place I went to was Stoke, the home of the English potteries, bang in the middle of England. And but, you know, again, very run down. In fact, it was where one of the people in one of the focus groups said to me, everybody in this focus group, their families would have either worked in the mines or in the potteries. Both are closed. Neither exist anymore. And she said, that's why we've lost our identity. So I did qualitative research primarily, but I married it together with what quantitative research existed to kind of really get under the skin of what had happened.
And so when you, based on your conversations and those groups, and I think you gave a little bit of insight into who they are, but this notion of a perceived glorious past, right? Being proud, that comes up over and over in the book, this pride in what they and their, you know, fathers and mothers did and grandfathers and grandmothers did in the past, and their pride in whether it's, as you said, Darlington as the home of the railway, or Stoke as having been the center of pottery. Like there was one company that's like famous, right, for their pottery in Stoke. And yet that the current and future outlook of those sectors is not very positive. So is in terms of understanding how folks in these parts of the country compare to, let's say, the Southeast, right? Mm-hmm. London is I know very unique in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of their value set, in terms of their outlook, how would you compare that those folks that you interviewed in the North and in the Midlands with other voters and other people across England in particular?
Yeah. So I think you have to be sort of slightly careful here actually. And a lot of people now are saying, I don't really buy this red wall stuff. And in a way, they're right, because I think that working class voters, wherever they are, very often hold similar values. So in some ways, some of the people that I met in Darlington or in Hindburn or in Stoke were not that different from the similar sorts of voters that I might have met in somewhere in the southeast, not London, not the big cities. This is an important thing. So what are the things that differentiate is that on the whole, I think the things that bind these people together is living in small communities, small towns, rather than big cities. Mm-hmm. And often small towns that are quite isolated. So for instance, Accrington, which is the biggest town in Hindburn constituency, is just 20 miles from Manchester, a big northern city in the UK. And it takes an hour and a half to get to Manchester by train, hour and a half to get 20 miles. And so people don't go to Manchester and don't have any connection with Manchester. So their lives are played out on two stages, if you like. One is the local community, and almost everybody I met, their family lived in the street next to them. You know, their friends were on there, they worked very locally. They didn't travel very far. And then the country, and that's another big theme, was patriotism. Mm. So I think a lot of Londoners that I've interviewed over the years, if you say, where do you come from? They'll say London. They won't say Britain. They'll say London. Just as I think a New Yorker might say New York. So you identify with your big city. It's a big sort of pulsating entity in its own right. Whereas, you know, the people in these small places have their own local community, which they identify with very closely, and then the whole country. Right. And they're very patriotic and very proud of the country. And that, you know, just to draw again on that parallel between the Rust Belt states and the Red Wall towns, is that, you know, I think that Trump tapped into that very effectively with Make America Great Again. You know, that slogan, talk to the past glory that these people all believed in. And I think, you know, in a way, it was very, very similar mood that I found in those places.
And on Brexit then, and I think that's where we see, despite, you know, history of, not despite, but a history of voting for the Labour Party in these constituencies, and then overwhelming majority voting to leave during the Brexit referendum, created that perhaps opportunity for the Tories, as you described, who would at least historically never be on the radar for any of these voters, because they saw them as just complete opposite of their values, their worldview, their history. And yet this created an opportunity, right? So based on your conversations, and you talk about this in the book, do you see the success that Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party had in basically converting these voters into Tories in a way? Is this a short-term Brexit, like get Brexit done effect? Yeah. Or do you see this potentially being a realignment in UK politics, like we've seen, as you described, in the US? And I think we'll talk about Canada later on in our conversation, but we're seeing the Conservatives here trying to do that. And we've seen some examples of conservative oriented parties trying to connect with working class voters in a way that maybe they weren't able to in the past.
Yeah. I mean, you know, is this a realignment or a one-off? Have those votes been loaned, as people, you know, a lot of headlines said that, and obviously only time is going to tell. To what extent was Brexit a trigger is another kind of a related question. And it was part of the story. And in those Red Wall seats, by the way, you know, two thirds of the people to three quarters, depending on which seat you're in, voted leave. Whereas, you know, as we know, 52% of the nation as a whole did. What that means, obviously, is that people in the cities predominantly voted remain. And that became a very big divide. But I think in a way you had a perfect storm of different things coming together. What I found was that when I asked people why they had voted Conservative, the first thing that they did was to tell me how little they, you know, they regarded the Labour Party and how poor they thought Labour was. So, and I would get this absolute sort of combination of, you know, kind of Labour being useless, frustration with Brexit and feeling not listened to. And then the other big thing was Boris Johnson himself. So, you know, they felt that he had, as one person put it, de-snobbified the Tory party. And this sounds Almost incredible if you think, you know, this is a man who went to the most expensive school in Britain and, you know, probably one of the most expensive schools in the world. You know, couldn't really, in a way, be more upper class. But he has, for people who know Boris Johnson's sort of persona, this kind of slightly disheveled but quite yeah. passionate sort of, you know, he feels very authentic to people, and he right. feels a bit different. He isn't the sort of slick politician. You know, sometimes he misspeaks, sometimes he gets things wrong, he makes mistakes, he follows his passions. And actually they felt somehow that he understood them, which is exactly what they felt that the Labour Party no longer did. So this was the other thing, and this was not as a result of Brexit. It wasn't as a result even of Jeremy Corbyn, the then leader, although they did not like him very much. But this is something that had been happening for a long time. There was a feeling that Labour, in cultural terms, if you like, had moved away mm-hmm. from those voters. And again, you know, to quote one of the people in one of my focus groups, who told me that Labour had now been taken over by a bunch of snooty London graduates. And that's another important thing, is that the people in these Red Wall seats were very much less likely to be graduates, very much less likely to be educated beyond, you know, 16 or 18, you know, working manual workers or, you know, care workers, rather than working, if you like, with their heads, working with their hands rather than their heads, or their hearts rather than their heads. So, you know, they felt that they had been abandoned by the people in cities who, you know, voted Remain, all had graduates, and crucially, who looked down on them.
Right.
And they felt judged. And you know what? They weren't wrong. They were being judged. And I find that, you know, right now, if I tweet anything about the Red Wall, which I do from time to time, if it's a news story or whatever, I will get a whole bunch of you know, kind of replies with people saying things like, why do we care what these racist people think, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's complex. There are a lot of things going on.
But it does seem that there was this, like, almost, I hate this term always, but perfect storm, where yeah. the conditions were created that each one by themselves would not be enough to explain this earthquake, this shift exactly. in vote behavior. Yeah. But each of them probably contributed to creating enough to push it over the edge, right? I do want to spend a little time on the Labour Party in particular, yeah. because I think, although Jeremy Corbyn is you know, a very different political leader than, let's say, Justin Trudeau, and there's different histories there, or even Joe Biden, I think one of the criticisms of progressive political parties, you know, you've seen the decline of the Social Democratic parties in Europe as an example, across the board, right? And while Justin Trudeau, no one would describe him as a social democrat or of kind of the Labour-esque movement, he is very much a progressive, and he wears that on his sleeve. And he is often criticized for being somewhat condescending or judging of people when yeah. it comes to issues around race or yeah. climate change or immigration, all issues that voters that you spoke to have very different views of than those that might live in London or Manchester or some mm-hmm. of the larger cities. You've seen the evolution of the Labour Party, having worked with Gordon Brown during the quote new Labour years. Was this something that was happening in your mind well before Jeremy Corbyn kind of took over the party? In these voters' minds, there was not a trigger for them to leave, but they over time they started to feel that the connection and the identity between those who ran the Labour Party and those who voted for the Labour Party was starting to sort of fray a little bit. That's how my yeah. sense of the history was. This was not yeah. just something that happened over the last 5 years. This was a longer term trend that we're seeing globally, in fact, between parties yeah. of the center left and the voting groups that have traditionally
yeah,
supported
yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely bang on. And I think that, you know, this was a slow car crash that, you know, if you look back on it, you could almost see it happening. And it, you know, it probably started during the Labour government, actually. But it then, you know, it sped up, and then it became turbocharged under Jeremy Corbyn, you know, whose values and issues seem very, very far from this group of people. But it, you know, it wasn't just on his watch. It was all the way through. Just a feeling that Labour didn't care, had lost connection with these people. And what I heard again and again, and it was obvious in a way that people would feel this when you reflect back on it, that, you know, a lot of these seats had been considered safe seats. So what would tend to happen in those safe seats was that, you know, the hierarchy of the party would put their favorite son or daughter, usually son as it happens, into that seat, and they've got a lovely safe seat that they don't have to work very hard because you can take it for granted. So, you know, the people in that constituency never saw their representative. You know, he would maybe pitch up once a month to do a surgery, and the rest of the time staff are running all the local affairs. You know, and it perpetuates the problem because, right, you know, the party has lost touch with those people and they have lost touch with the party.
Right.
It's a vicious circle.
So, just two points of clarification for our listeners who may not follow British politics or government closely. First of all, surgery, that MP is not going up to actually do, you know, medical surgeries. It's what you would term like meetings with constituents, yeah, right? Like you open door, kind of come in and meet local constituencies. Yeah. And second is, unlike in Canada, we have a pretty strong convention that if you represent a constituency, you live in the constituency, or you're often from the area you represent. That's not always the case in the UK, right?
In fairness, I think we have quite a strong tradition of that too. But, you know, there are, and you'll find that particularly the case in marginal seats, you know, seats that are much more closely fought, where, you know, you will throw everything at that and you will definitely try and
find
and
a local. Get,
but sometimes, you know, and this was particularly because it showed how these seats were being taken for granted.
Right.
And this group of people felt taken for granted. And, you know, the decline that they had seen in their area, and, you know, the inability and unwillingness of governments to do anything to sort of replace the economic decline was very closely connected with this. You know, this has all happened on Labour's watch.
One of the, I did an interview with, his name's David Shore. He's a data scientist, worked on the Obama campaign in 2012. And he made an interesting statement to me in describing Donald Trump's success. And he said, look, Donald Trump did something that no Republican ever had done before, which is saying, I'm not going to privatize, or I'm not going to cut your Medicare. I'm not going to cut Social Security. But I am going to, you know, maybe reduce immigration. So he, in other words, he found a way to bring the most popular ideas on both sides of the spectrum together, yes, and appeal to a group of voters that in the past had voted on certain issues that aligned with the issue salience of the day or with what the parties were running on. And mm-hmm. I think there's an interesting parallel with Boris Johnson in that I'm not certain any other conservative leader could get away with what he's even proposed, right? Like, you know, there's still memories of austerity, which is why I think for a long time, the Tories probably had a hard time connecting with working yeah. class voters. But it almost feels like Johnson's kind of scrubbed that away and said, we're not that Tory party. We're the Tory party that, you know, thinks of big government in a way, and we're going to do whatever we need to do. But at the same time, connects with those voters on a cultural basis who says, we need to slow immigration, or we need to get out of the UK, out of the EU. And so it almost created a version of the Conservative Party that could appeal to these voters, whereas Labour actually became far more ideologically pure in a way. There was you were for nationalization, and you were, you know, you had to be the Israel-Palestine debate, I know, gets complicated in the Labour Party.
It sure does.
Yeah. Like those kinds of things, it became far more difficult to see yourself in the Labour Party because it became much more cosmopolitan, as you described, London and educated, and less like the broader coalition. Is that, does that help explain, I think, a little bit of what's happened?
I think that is right. And I think that, you know, your observations about Boris Johnson are also correct. And I think that, you know, it's in some ways he's been an unlucky prime minister, because how unlucky is anybody to find themselves, you know, kind of at the helm when you have something like coronavirus strike. But, you know, what it has also done is has enabled him to sort of throw away, if you like, the Tory rule book and to say that we're going to do things differently because we have to do things differently in these circumstances. So, you know, and I think that has enabled him massively to be able to sort of, you know, ride those two horses. And, you know, he had a wobbly period last autumn. Keir Starmer, the new Labour leader, was doing pretty well, and the coronavirus response was not going so well at that point. But obviously has had a massive recovery. As I said earlier, you know, the vaccination program is going very well in the UK, and that has, you know, that has worked well for him. But it remains to be seen. There's, you know, I think there's a lot of water to go under the bridge probably before the next election. Right. And as I say, that public mood is very volatile. I think it would be an idiot to try to predict what might happen next.
So one of the really interesting, you talked about it in our interview, about how many people who live in these communities that are isolated, they feel taken for granted, they feel that they've been left behind. There's two points in your book that I thought were interesting. One was this divide between, and we see it in our polling in Canada, I mentioned to you in sort of our pre-discussion, when you ask Canadians, do you look at the future of the economy and see opportunities, more opportunities than threats, or do you see more threats than opportunities? Mm-hmm. And in Canada, we actually have about 50-50 on either side of that divide. Mm-hmm. And where you fall then, I think, says a lot about where you live, your level of education, your ability to adapt to change, and your willingness to embrace change, right? So that to me explains a lot of what's happening in many, you know, modern democracies today, where the economy is changing so quickly and, you know, value and wealth is shifting in real ways. Is that, I guess, to sum up in a way what you were hearing, does that help explain so much of what was going on up in these constituencies that you visited and spoke to people in outside of the coronavirus context, like in the moment before this crisis actually started?
Yeah, I think it does. And in fact, most of the fieldwork I did was before, luckily, from my point of view, mm-hmm. before coronavirus, I was actually able to interview people face to face and go in their houses and do things I wouldn't be able to do right now because the Market Research Society would ban me for doing it. But I people didn't talk about themselves as red wall voters, but they talked about left behind communities, and they felt that their community was left behind. And, you know, as you say, this is part of the global economy, but people felt that very deeply in their own lives. And for many, the future outlook was bleak and pessimistic. But there's a really interesting thing here, which I think also points to one of the things that Boris Johnson did very successfully, and at the last election, Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, did much less successfully, which is how you respond to that. And I think Jeremy Corbyn's response would have been, you know, sort of tearing his hair out, wringing his hands, you know, poor, poor people, isn't life terrible for you? Boris Johnson has a very positive, optimistic outlook, and people love that. Because actually what they wanted was a bit of hope. You know, they didn't want somebody to share their pain. They wanted somebody to say, I think we can make this place better for you. And that was the message that they took out of Boris Johnson's promise to them. Now, that then means, you know, the bar for him is quite high. They are expecting quite a lot. You know, they felt that they've been very neglected. They now know their political power, if you like. And I think the whole relationship at that point becomes much more transactional,
right?
The relationship between voter and politician. So the voter is saying, okay, you know, you promised me this, where is it?
Right.
And so there's going to be a lot of delivery to be done, I think.
So I'm going to ask you one final question that I didn't actually give you ahead of time, but we are recording this interview on Earth Day. And right now, as we speak, President Biden is hosting world leaders virtually to talk about, you know, and everyone's upping their targets for climate. As you know, in Canada, you know, we're an energy country, one of the largest producers. And one of the big debates we have here is a regional debate between the energy producing provinces or regions of the country and those that don't rely on oil and gas to drive their economy. And I think we're headed towards a debate, and we should already be having it, of what happens to people who are displaced by changes in the economy, and in this case, a transition away from fossil fuels. What lessons can you take from your conversations and your career of research looking at how voters in economically depressed areas are going to respond to this? How best should we be, you know, both developing, I'm not asking for policy solutions, but the communications of speaking to Albertans, for example, people who live in Alberta, who are incredibly worried that this rush to transition away from fossil fuels will mean they will be left behind. Because I think we're seeing that in our politics in Canada, right? Those regions that produce energy now know that it's not going to last forever, but they don't know what that future looks like. What's your sense of how we approach that?
Yeah, I think that is such a critical question. And it, in a way, how the future plays out will depend in part on how politicians' response to that. Because of course, you know, these places often that a very big part of their economically, you know, kind of being left behind is the loss of coal mining, for example. That's one mm-hmm. of the things that they all had in common. And those traditional industries that don't exist anymore, very often that are related to, an environmentally unfriendly way of doing things. And I think that there is a way through, but it has to be navigated. The comms have to be incredibly careful around it and how you talk about it. I think that you need to talk about the sense of it being like another industrial revolution, make it very exciting and forward-looking. I think for them, they're less concerned about the environmental piece. That matters a lot to people in London who are blissfully unaffected by it, of course. But actually to talk about jobs and industries and something that is happening in their local area that is sustainable, that will last. And I think can play to this patriotism piece as well. Mm. And I think, you know, it's up to every nation how they tackle this and how they do it. But I think it's showing that this, what is essentially a global initiative, can work for us in the UK or for you in Canada, and what it means and what your own take on that is going to be very important.
Yeah, and I think that's great insight. And I would just add, based on your findings, if folks in these parts of the country have such deep identity to the past, and are so proud of that past, they can never feel that we're judging them to say that past, you know, hurt the world or it's the reason we're here. Because if they feel that way, they're going to be incredibly defensive. They're not going to listen to how we move forward, right? That past has been, and it is, the oil and gas sector in Canada has allowed us to be as wealthy and successful as we are. In the same way that coal was what drove the industrial revolution in the UK. It created an empire. We have to celebrate that, but also say it has to change if we're going to enjoy the next 50 years together. Yeah, right?
Exactly. I mean, just a little example of that was doing some work fairly recently for a trade union client, actually, where we were looking at the concept of green jobs with these sorts of voters. And at one point, one of them just sort of said in a slightly puzzled tone, "Look, obviously we want jobs around here, but do they have to be green? I'm not that bothered." It was sort of like, with your communications, focus on the things that they care about, not the things you wish they cared about or think they ought to care about.
It's so true. Because we get, we get locked into
does it matter to you?
It's no different than, it's very similar to London in that, you know, people here live sometimes in a bubble. They only think about what they care about. But in many parts of the country, climate change is nowhere near the top issue. Jobs is at the top. Having healthcare for their families and having enough resources. Anyways, Deborah, thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure. And I encourage everybody to pick up your book and books. This is your second book. It's a real insight into not just what's going on in the UK, but I think there's applications in other parts of the world. Definitely. So thank you so much.
That global economy, really. Great. Thank you. Lovely to meet you.